Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Duane Freitas.
This week, the launch of the Moto X, the first phone built from the ground up by Google, the Tor Anonymity Network may have been hacked by the FBI, Apple gets slapped for ebook price fixing, President Obama bails Apple out, and your Amazon Gold Box deal of the day, one Washington Post slightly used. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com and checking out our subscription link on the right-hand sidebar. And, of course, you can connect with us at facebook.com and twitter.com at The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com and search for The Drill Down there. How you doing, Duane?
I'm all right. A little busy in startup land.
Tosin will be joining us a little bit later in the show. He's just running a little bit late, so we should expect to see him in about 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. All right, let's jump right into these headlines here. Last year at about this time, Google purchased Motorola Mobility, and much speculation was made, including here on The Drill Down, as to what Google's strategy for the mobile manufacturer would be. That strategy became a little clearer last week with Motorola's launch of the Moto X at a news conference in New York. With its first smartphone designed completely in-house, and by the way, the first smartphone to be assembled in the U.S., Google demonstrates one of the benefits of moving production to the U.S. It's letting buyers customize phones to give them their own style. With the Moto X, Motorola is going to offer 18 different back covers, ranging in color from spearmint to cabernet, a choice of black or white fronts, and seven different metallic accents or details for details like the volume button, which makes for a total of 252 possible style variations of the phone. Now, the phone itself isn't phenomenally high-tech or overwhelming. It looks a lot, looks a lot like other smartphones. It's got a 4.7-inch touchscreen. It's got a no-frills implementation of the Android operating system. The most unusual feature of the Moto X, apart from the customization, is that it's always listening for its owner's voice. When it hears the phrase, "Okay, Google now," followed by a command like "call Bob," for example, it'll wake up from standby and execute the command, provided it understands it. Most smartphones have voice control like this, but they're usually activated by pressing a button like Siri. You know, you have to push it and hold down the home button to get Siri to fire up. Did you check out the launch of the Moto X, and what did you think of the Moto X, and what do you think about Google's strategy in general in providing a no-frills, very utilitarian phone for the masses?
I mean, I think that these colors are frills. The ability to customize your phone, yeah, it's a frill. These are significant amounts of frills. Did they go super hardcore on the unlike the triple core, you know, 5 gigahertz mobile chip thing? No, they didn't do that. They're software guys with some interest in hardware through Google Glass and the devices. But the fact is, you know, they're doing what I think is the right thing to do. I've seen a lot of reviews saying, "Oh, it's a middling phone. There's nothing exciting about it. Yada yada yada." But I mean, when you look at so many people with their iPhones who don't know what it's capable of, the thing about it is that the device itself is relatively inexpensive. You can get an iPhone 4S for $99 or an iPhone 4 for $1. It does all this stuff. It has all these apps for it, and it's a very reliable device with a very usable interface. Android naked, just Google's version of Android on the Moto X, that's a reliable interface that's going to work well on the hardware they've put it on. They've optimized the software for this hardware. So if it's done right, it shouldn't feel slow. You shouldn't feel like you need a Maserati to get around to get around town. And I think that's what Google's kind of go for with this device, which is, you know, not what a lot of reviewers have gone for. They were like, oh, I wasn't wowed because it wasn't this incredible, you know, Tesla Model S of a vehicle, mobile device. So I feel like that's what's that's kind of the sentiment that's out there. But really, if they can get the average consumer to say, that's Google's phone, it's a reliable phone. I know Motorola from a long time ago. I know Google. This is their phone. Yeah, I'll give it a shot. And make it not expensive, but make it really reliable, make the experience really tight. You don't have to worry about hardware. You know, let people focus on the people aspects of it. What does it look like? What can I make it look like? How can I make it mine? These are things that matter to people. That's why iPhone cases are such a big deal.
I found it interesting. Also, another headline that came up today that may add a little color to this conversation is that Android's smartphone share is up is at 80% in contrast to Apple. Apple has given up the market dominance to Android at this point. So you know, this is a ripe field for people to step in and get a phone like this one.
People have, I mean, it sounds like there are a lot of Android phones in the market. How quickly do people switch? I don't know, but there are always new people coming in. There are always teenagers who are able to get their first phone. There's always like those people who've been holdouts with, you know, the flip phones who are like, well, I need something, and the carriers simply don't want to sell flip phones or feature phones, we're calling them now, anymore. They want to sell these devices. So if this can be had at a reasonable price.
Yeah, $200 is what it starts at.
Yeah, $200. That's the problem I have with the device. It's a little expensive for what it is. You can get a top of the line, you know, Samsung or something for around $200 if you've been a customer for a while.
But I don't think does it require? I'm trying to see if it requires a contract with that $200, or if it's just $200 flat unlocked.
Yeah, it's definitely something we're looking at. I don't recall the last time I saw a phone that was just $200. For the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But in any event, I feel like as long as it seems a little pricey for a contract-tied phone.
It's going to be available in less than a month at all four national wireless carriers, Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile. So,
yeah, the off-contract price for the Motorola X is $700. So that means $200 is definitely tied to tied. I mean, that money, that's a lot of cost, but the fact is it was built in America, that costs more.
I guess that's true. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember what the price of an iPhone 5 is with the contract too. I think that's $200.
It's $200. Yeah. It's exactly $200. Yeah. It's $199, is that what I
said? So what we're saying is the iPhone has all the frills. The Moto X has very few frills.
It depends on who you are, though.
Yeah.
A lot of hardcore Android users would say, I wouldn't buy an iPhone because the processor is too slow. I wouldn't buy an iPhone because it doesn't have enough RAM. I wouldn't buy an iPhone for all these things. I think the Moto X, if you probably put it right next to the iPhone 5, the specs are probably okay. They're not amazing for an Android phone, which typically has... like the Windows devices that were also like Windows devices, it typically is a hardware game to get the most, you know, performance out of the software. But since Google's both building the hardware and the software, they can begin to scale back on the hardware costs and play the Apple game. And I think that's what's significant here.
It's probably what Google is counting on is building up that leverage against Apple at this point. All right, let's move on here. Members of Congress have been repeatedly thwarted when attempting to learn basic information about the NSA and the secret FISA court, which authorizes its activities, according to documents provided by two House members. This comes courtesy of Glenn Greenwald, by the way, of the Guardian, who is doing an excellent job on all of the NSA leaks and the follow-up stories, the surrounding stories about that. From the beginning of the NSA controversy, the agency's defenders have insisted that Congress is aware of the disclosed programs and exercises robust supervision over them. However, members of Congress are unaware of the very existence of these programs, let alone their capabilities. Beyond that, members who seek out basic information, including about NSA programs, they're required to vote on and FISA court rulings on the legality of those programs find that they are unable to obtain it. Moreover, even when members of the Intelligence Committee learn of what they believe to be serious abuses by the NSA, they are barred from law from informing the public. For example, a couple of Democratic committee members of the Senate, Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, spent years warning Americans that they would be stunned to learn of the radical interpretations of the secret law the Obama administration had adopted in the secret FISA court to vest themselves with extremist surveillance powers. Yet those two senators, prohibited by law from talking about it, concealed what they had discovered. It took Edward Snowden's whistleblowing for Americans to learn what the two Intelligence Committee members were so dramatically warning them about. What did you think about this?
I guess, what are you to do if you're a congressperson and you're subject to understanding these things? We don't live in a true democracy. We live in a representative government. So it's really all about the people we vote making decisions, not us making decisions. This is one of those things about America. It's worked for a very long time, and maybe it's not working anymore, but it's not something that's going to change very quickly. So we'd better get used to it. These guys have consciences. They wanted to let people know, but the consequences to them were low. I mean, if you think about it, you're a congressman. You've worked so hard to get there. You've done all this stuff, and you can't end up like getting thrown in jail or you know, getting, you know, not being able to take care of your family, etc. Edward Snowden is 29 years old, doesn't have kids or anything like that, doesn't have any crazy big ties. So he's not losing as much to do what he did. And because of that, I feel like, you know, it makes sense that someone so young would want to move on that. And frankly, in some ways, naive, right? These congressmen know what would happen if they had did whatever Snowden did. And they were maybe more afraid to do it, or maybe they were too smart to do it. we can't tell. But yeah, this is definitely eye-opening. And, you know, privacy is constantly a big deal. It's now I'm glad it's in our face, but it's sad what it's taken us to get here.
I think there's something inherently wrong with an organization that is working ostensibly for the people and in the name of the people, and yet the people cannot obtain information about what that organization is doing. In particular, things that they're doing that the people who they're doing it for might consider distasteful or even unconstitutional.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of a, I think my younger cousins would refer to it as a hot mess.
Yes, yes. Okay, well, let's move on here. A piece of malicious software that takes advantage of a Firefox security vulnerability to identify some users of the privacy-protecting Tor anonymity network showed up Sunday morning on multiple websites hosted by the anonymous hosting company Freedom Hosting. That would normally be considered a blatantly criminal drive-by hack attack, but nobody's calling in the FBI this time because the FBI is the prime suspect. The code is likely the first sample captured in the wild of the FBI's Computer and Internet Protocol Address Verifier, or CIPAV. The FBI has been using the CIPAV since 2002 against hackers, online sexual predators, extortionists, and others, primarily to identify subjects who are disguising their location by using proxy servers or anonymity services like Tor. And in fact, this code was uncovered in conjunction with the arrest of the guy who runs Freedom Hosting, Eric Marquez, in Ireland, on charges that he was distributing child pornography or allowing it to be distributed through Freedom Hosting.
Yeah, I mean, like,
it's a very sticky
situation.
Do you
kill the messenger?
Yes.
I mean, this kind of reminds me of the Julian Assange stuff.
Like, yeah, yeah.
If you can't get them for what they're doing,
right?
You can investigate, you know, them for those things that can't be questioned. like sexual abuse is a reason to bring somebody in.
Sure.
Julian Assange is for that. And, you know, the fact is, I don't know how unscrupulous or scrupulous these people are.
Yeah.
So you're running a network that allows anything to happen.
Uh-huh.
Is it a stretch to believe that you're allowing child pornography to happen? Is it a stretch to believe that if you're doing the WikiLeaks thing that that you may have, you know, engaged in sexual abuse? I don't know. I think that these questions are just kind of out there. And it's this idea of breaking down the credibility, breaking down the person, it's a strange thing. I mean, the people who run a lot of these technologies are strong personalities, and they rub people the wrong way.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see. It's interesting to think about. I don't know if to see, but it's interesting to think about whether or not some of these ways of getting them down are tactics to get them locked up, or if these are actually, you know, real things. But it's, you know, Julian Assange, we might never know. He's just kind of living in an embassy. But right. With this tour guy, I mean, we'll find out, right? Like, it's a mess.
I, you know, it's interesting because, and a situation like this is really interesting because, you know, the Tor service can be used for a lot of things, not necessarily illegal things. We're talking about, like, you know, it can be used by human rights groups and journalists to protect their sources.
Oh, yeah. Plenty of these things can be used all over the place. But the fact is, it's just like anything. You could be a superhero, but if you kill one innocent person, you're going to go to jail.
Yeah.
Tor could be used for all sorts of stuff, but if they can find that you've been allowing the transmission of pornographic content, then you're going to be locked up, and right. You know, you're going to have to rely heavily on the terms of service that you have with your users, and your liability situation. Like, can you blame them? Can you identify them? Like, it rolls downhill. So if you're a law enforcement service, you can do one of two things. You can go after the guy who runs it and have him go after the people who are doing the bad stuff, or you can subpoena the guy who runs it to give up the people who are doing the bad stuff, or the stuff that you suspect is bad. Those are their options, and they're putting the screws on one way or the other.
I'm wondering if the intent was to remove a service that was used to host child porn, or if the intent was to remove an anonymous service in general, because...
Well, I think it serves. I mean, the anonymous service, even if it's not doing child porn, which it very well may be, the fact is it's doing, you know, it's likely allowing for copyrighted content to be distributed. And so there's a lot of special interests who would like to see that kind of thing go down. The government would like to know who's communicating with who. The special interests would like to make sure that their stuff isn't being copied. And everybody would like to make sure that you know, child pornography isn't working. So
sure. There
are more interests against this than there are for it.
All right, let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And in light of this weekend's premiere of the final episodes of Breaking Bad, the Audible book that I wanted to recommend this week is called Difficult Men, Behind the Scenes of a Creative Revolution from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad by Brett Martin. Just as the big novel had in the 1960s and the subversive films of New Hollywood had in the 1970s, television shows became the place to go to see stories of the triumph and betrayals of the American dream at the beginning of the 21st century. This revolution happened at the hands of a new breed of auteur, the all-powerful writer-showrunner. These were men nearly as complicated, idiosyncratic, and, quote, difficult, as the conflicted protagonists that defined the genre. Difficult Men takes us behind the scenes of our favorite shows, delivering the never-before-heard story after story and revealing how cable television has distinguished itself dramatically from the networks, emerging from the shadows of film to become a truly significant and influential part of our culture. I thought this was an interesting book. I'm going to have to check this out because I'm fascinated by, first of all, I'm fascinated about the sort of the glimpse behind the scenes of what it takes to to write one of these shows, these shows like Sopranos, The Wire, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, all of these shows are so strongly written that, I mean, they completely pivot around their writing staff. It would be a fascinating look to find out what
it's the opposite of, like, the Lost model, where, like, we just need it to go on for as long as possible before people hate it.
Well, in Lost defense, like, I will always defend Lost. In Lost defense, I think that they had a pretty strong writing staff too. They kind of knew where they were going, but they all right.
Not going to give that to you. There were seasons, multiple seasons where they didn't know where they were going, and they realized in order to save the legacy of the property, they had to figure out where they were going.
I think thus the
one time announcement in season 4 that Lost will end in season 6 or whatever that was. So that was a coup and a change in the way that broadcast TV does its shows. But the fact is, HBO doesn't tell you necessarily, or these guys rarely tell you when the last season is going to be until it's upon us. Whereas Lost was like, we got to tell these people something because we just don't know where it's going. Our friend J.J. Abrams, he's wonderful at starting things, and then he usually moves on to another project and leaves it in the hands of whomever. It's a great model to have because everything, you know, that he's a part of when he's a part of it is awesome. Aaron Sorkin had the same issue when he was at the West Wing. You know, it was wonderful while he was there, and then he left it, and then people started complaining that it had lost its charm.
Yeah, that show was open ended. That show didn't know where it was going, but Lost definitely did have a planned ending.
It didn't have a planned middle, is my point.
That was their fatal flaw, is that they didn't know how long they would have to keep juggling the plates before they got to that ending.
Which is the problem with network TV. I think what you're saying with cable TV, what they're able to do, the focus on creativity, because they know that the receipts and the revenue are going to come in anyhow, and the focus on art, creating film art, that's good. Now, if only we could have shows that were this powerful that used women as the protagonists and had women showrunners. Right now, when you have a strong, powerful female lead in a violent role, she becomes either a sex object or a bitch. A guy is just cool. And the only way that women can really get this kind of power is when you look at them in shows like 30 Rock or Weeds. And 30 Rock, she doesn't use her sex in order to do anything, but it has to be a comedy in order for her to seem disarming enough for us to enjoy it. In Weeds, she's slightly comedic, but the fact is she uses sex appeal to get whatever she wants.
I'm going to cite a couple of examples. Damages and The Good Wife, which...
I don't think those shows have the same level of exceptional, mind-altering writing and powerful communication and social mystique that the shows that you mentioned in the book have. You know, I think those are good shows. I think those shows have strong female leads, but they don't have the following and the cultural... they're not cultural heavyweights the way The Sopranos was, Breaking Bad is. They're not blockbuster TV shows.
Yeah.
You know?
I'll give you that.
So, I mean, like, I don't think that time is never coming. I just can't wait till it does. The last blockbuster TV show that involved a female character was both action and comedic, and that was Buffy.
All right. I'm going to counter with one that you probably haven't seen yet, which is Orange is the New Black. I think that one is a strong contender to break into this.
I'm excited to actually check it out.
Yeah. In any case, to download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 10,000-plus titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Even if you don't like the service, you can cancel it and you still get to keep the book for free. All right, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, Apple gets some bad news and some good. And Amazon's founder did some recent shopping of his own. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Strange, enchanted boy. They say he wandered very and be loved in return. If
you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas, and we are now joined by Tosin Unifowaken. How you doing, Tosin?
Doing pretty well. Ready to get into the drill down and talk more tech.
All right, so let's jump into it. In July, the Justice Department won its antitrust lawsuit that accused Apple of conspiring with publishers to raise the prices of ebooks. The Justice Department last Friday proposed guidelines that would put rules in place to prevent Apple from facilitating price fixing amongst publishers or from retaliating against publishers that refuse to bend to its terms. The Justice Department also suggested that Apple allow Amazon and Barnes & Noble to insert links inside their ebook apps to their ebook stores so that consumers can easily compare prices of ebooks. Apple said the government's proposal was a draconian and putative intrusion into its business that violates basic principles of fairness and due process. What do you think? Do you think that this is it violates basic principles of fairness and due process for Apple?
I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but I don't know what fairness means in terms of like a lawsuit. You know, like what's fairness here? Due process? It seems very much like they went through a rigorous, you know, legal challenge and they lost. They had the money and the expertise to represent themselves, and they lost. So I think due process, just from a layman's perspective, seems to be pretty well served. Fairness, I don't know. Is it fair that they could run around and tell publishing companies, hey, you better join us or else your app doesn't get through, as we've seen in some of the email exchanges between Forrestal and Jobs? Is it fair that the only way to buy a book is via the web? You can't buy it through Apple unless you want to pay them 30%. Like, that model seems a little strange. I get it. Apple owns the OS, but imagine if Windows said anything you purchase while you're using a Windows system, you'd have to do via, you know, you'd have to give 30% to Microsoft. That'd be strange. So I don't know. I don't know if it's all this stuff, but it seems to me as if they got caught with their hand in a pretty gross cookie jar. And they're having to deal with it. I don't know that it's necessarily – I think they built the platform. They invested in the platform. Yeah. Should they get paid on the platform? Part of me thinks yes. Part of me also thinks that they've shown that with all the power they have, they're willing to abuse it. And that's maybe where that punitive damage comes in. Like, hey, you're not – oh, it's not okay for you to abuse the – you know, to be this strong.
I definitely agree here. They did go through the entire legal process and they did lose. It seems like Apple is trying to pull one of the typical legal moves that you see where people try and extend the trial and push back getting fined or push back, you know, the consequences. And unfortunately, our justice system allows a lot of that. Well, I don't know if I can really consider that unfortunate. It really depends on the situation, I guess.
Yeah,
that is how our justice system is. But I think this has been going on for so long that I think it's time that we finally put a close to this story.
Speaking of putting a close to stories, the Obama administration on Saturday vetoed the U.S. International Trade Commission's ban on the import and sale of some Apple iPhones and iPads, which is a rare move that upends a legal victory for smartphone rival Samsung. U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman made the decision to veto the ban on the Apple devices, citing concerns about patent holders gaining undue leverage as well as potential harm to consumers and competitive conditions in the U.S. economy. It's the first such veto in more than 25 years. And some say that it promises to upend long-running battles over intellectual property in the smartphone market and change the strategy of some of the world's biggest tech companies that, that they use to defend their inventions.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like Apple just complained about fairness.
Yeah.
You know, they're getting hooked up from the administration
yes.
on this front, and they're getting chided for bad behavior by the administration and the courts, really. The courts, yeah. really. Not the administration, right. but the administration bringing the case against them and the courts making the decision on the other front. So they did something that was whack with this book sharing thing. The emails yeah. are smoking guns. And then on this this patent thing, the U.S. is sticking up for its own and saying, hey, look, this company has led the mobile revolution. And the way that these patents are being read does not jibe with the, you know, like with the way that they're working for. I'm sure Samsung's saying this is not fair and there hasn't been enough due process. The U.S. just made a sweeping gesture. So I don't know why Apple's complaining, I guess is what I'm saying. They're getting a lot. Now, when it comes to the way patents are looked at, this ITC ruling
yeah.
is something that you can try to cite if you're in some sort of case around
yep.
this,
yep.
but it doesn't hold the same weight as U.S. court citing, you know, citing a U.S. court's decision about something. But it does show that the sentiment of intelligent and powerful people is that there's some bullshit.
That's a technical term.
There's some bullshit when it comes to patents.
The patent holding groups such as the Innovation Alliance say that they were tremendously disappointed by this decision, which it said represented perhaps the worst of all possible outcomes, a decision that overturns decades of settled understanding without clear guidance for licensing negotiations. So it's clear that the patent holding groups would be upset about this.
Yeah. Well, however, when he slices it, no one's going to be happy. I mean, if we had gone with the road, this is how patents work, whatever, yeah. you sit there and you say, hey, look, Asia's been stealing U.S. patents forever, right? Just forever. Like, since the beginning of patents, China has been stealing them. Since the beginning of intellectual property, China's been like, I don't know, guys. Can we knock that off? Because that's part of our economic plan is to copy shit that other people have invented. I'm just going to go out there and say it. I love China, but there's definitely some nonsense when it comes to that. So to say, oh, now we're gonna play fair. We can't always. I don't know. I feel like you have to protect your industries, especially when mm-hmm. Apple is as powerful as big oil right now.
You think it's unfair that Apple had Obama on their side and stepping in against the U.S. International Trade Commission's ruling, like. It's like,
well, it's the International Trade Commission. It's based in the U.S., but it is the International Trade Commission. And the administration said this is not in our interest, and therefore I'm going to veto it because it's based in the U.S. and I have that jurisdiction to veto it. And I think it was a decision that is going to prove very popular with technology companies. But on the other hand, it may very well lead to Apple feeling pressure to put together a lobbying group, which is something that Apple's been against.
Yeah.
The Politico recently had an article about how Apple needs to get themselves a lobbyist so they can protect themselves from all these attacks from the book situation and the tax situation. So basically, it's almost as if there's this, and I think John Gruber has said this also, it's almost as if there's this shakedown going on, like, you need to pay up to Washington in order to get whatever. And I think that it's interesting to see that this situation with Obama and the administration and protecting Apple was a freebie. It didn't involve any kind of influence by Apple, only yeah. the fact yeah. that they're a very strong company and that yeah. their value is recognized. And we're not going to have their value depleted or diminished by this ruling from outside of our, you know, outside of normal jurisdiction. So I think that there's something to that.
Okay, let's move on here. This is our last headline here before we talk about our viral video, our video of the week. And it's a big one. The Washington Post agreed Monday to sell its flagship newspaper to Amazon.com founder Jeff Bezos, ending the Graham family's stewardship of one of the America's leading news organizations after four generations. Bezos, whose entrepreneurship has made him one of the world's richest men, will pay $250 million in cash for the Post. Amazon.com itself will have no role in the purchase. Bezos himself will become the Post's sole owner when the sale is completed. The deal represents a sudden and stunning turn of events for the Post. Few people were aware that a sale was in the works for the paper. And in a letter to Post employees, Bezos said, "The values of the Post do not need changing. The paper's duty will remain to its readers and not to the private interests of owners. There will, of course, be change at the Post over the coming years. That's essential and would have happened with or without new ownership. The internet is transforming almost every element of news business, shortening news cycles, eroding long, reliable revenue sources, and enabling new kinds of competition, some of which bear no news-gathering costs. There's no map, and charting a path ahead will not be easy. We'll need to invent, which means we'll need to experiment." There's no clear answer as to why Jeff Bezos decided to purchase the Post. There's a lot of speculation.
I mean, it's content, guys. It's good content. I don't think he's in a position where he doesn't really have to worry about changing the focus of this content. He doesn't have to say, hey, I need this to be a liberal newspaper. I need this to be a conservative newspaper. He can let it be a newspaper that has the ideals that we see on shows like HBO's Newsroom, because he knows that he can afford to A, subsidize, or B, figure out, he can spend time figuring out a way to monetize, and that'll allow him to have a news organization that stands head and shoulders above the rest. I mean, the Washington Post is a great organization, but the fact is, it's not exactly the New York Times. So you do what so many do. Like, Facebook bought Gowalla. They didn't buy Foursquare. Buy that second runner-up.
Right.
Buy that runner-up and integrate that into your existing logistics chain and see what you can do to make it better. I think there's a lot. I mean, he may not have bought it for Amazon, but the Washington Post on the Kindle is going to become, you know, better than it has been before, I guarantee.
Yeah, at a time, right?
Does
he get 2-day shipping for his purchase?
Right. I mean, if he wants to add it to Prime, there you go. If you want to add it to Prime in terms of the digital subscription, you know, Prime costs $8 a month now, or you can spend $13 a month and have access to the entire Washington Post on your tablet, on your phone, and on the web, unlike the crazy $35 a month that the New York Times is asking for full access to its site. So, yeah.
Major news organizations are contracting. They're getting sold off and closing shop left and right. I just wanted to throw out a few of the reasons being speculated as to why Bezos might have bought this paper.
Well, clearly it's part of his plan to take over the world. I mean, where have you been, Pinky?
Some people say that they believe that the Post's website could be a major new sales and advertising platform for him, which seems credible. They believe that the Washington Post could be a credible outlet for more original video news content, because it's just starting to get into that video, producing original video stuff, and that Bezos bought the Post to sort of kick that into gear and make that a major part of the newspaper. Some people think that it's simply just a challenge, that he's buying this because he sees it as a big business opportunity, a new market for him to figure out and conquer in a way that he figured out a way not to only sell books online, but batteries and razor blades as well. And some people say that he wants to have more influence in Washington, and he bought a platform to do just that.
The robber baron days of buying a newspaper, starting a newspaper to get your word out there, you know, those days are over, but you can see how they might be thought of as coming back in an age of internet super mega rich people. Jeff Bezos has come across as someone who, you know, is definitely a liberal thinker in the true sense of the word liberal, not capital L political, but like actually a person who's very open-minded and is constantly looking for a new way to expand his offering, to move things forward, to not take anything off the table in terms of an option. That's been consistent. That's why Amazon's grown, because the only consistent thing about Amazon is its change. I don't think it's in the character that we've come to know of Jeff Bezos to create the MSNBC of newspapers or the anti-Rupert Murdoch of newspapers. I don't think that's right. Where he is.
Right. Like that's a great example there, because I think what Rupert Murdoch was trying to do with the Daily was just a mistake waiting to happen. And I think that's the wrong approach to try to integrate major news into digital delivery system. I'm curious as to what Bezos might be thinking of doing with the Post itself.
Yeah, this is a storied news organization. I mean, Watergate, the Pentagon Papers.
Yeah.
There's legacy that he has to preserve. He could have bought, I mean, Newsweek also has legacy, but not the type of legacy that the Washington Post has. So he could have bought that for, I'm sure, much less money than $250 million. But he didn't. He put himself out there. I mean, the owners were marketing, shopping it privately, and he went and he spent, you know, big chunk of change on that, and that's what's up. So, you know, I think we're all have to just spend some time contemplating this and seeing what he's about to do.
The awesome thing for him is he has the flexibility of doing whatever he wants. He's not beholden to anyone really in this deal. So yeah. It's his money, his pocket, and I think that's really where the power will originate from, the flexibility he has around that.
Let's not forget, we've seen really wealthy tech guys do stuff like this before. Steve Jobs created Pixar, right? He bought into Disney as a board member. These are the kinds of things that that these people do. They want to diversify their interests. I mean, he's 47 or 49. So he's got a long life. He's very healthy. He's got a long life ahead of him, and he's going to do what he can to make it as interesting and, I think, to change the world. You know, you look at guys like Elon Musk, and they decided to go and reestablish the way cars are made and the way space travel is done.
Right.
Only after they redesigned the way we pay for things. And Jeff Bezos, I think, is on the same path. He's redefined the mall. He's redefined the shopping experience through Amazon. It's almost as real time as buying it in a store. But it's everything. There's nothing you can't get there, really. So he's hopefully going to take that skill set and apply it to something that I think all Americans have consistently been proud of.
We talked before before the show, Dwayne, about robber barons. Do you think that this will herald a trend of entrepreneurs buying old media? Like for example, could you see someone like a Google buying the New York Times?
I mean, I don't know. I don't think a lot of the new media can exist without the old media. You see all these blogs, this Huffington Post, all this stuff. They're still getting the base information from the old media, right?
Yeah.
Like, I guess, with the tech blogs, they're talking directly to the people, but
the line
for
is
a lot
blurred
of these reblog
these
things,
days.
I was saying a lot of these reblog things, the investigative journalism is still happening from the ABCs, NBCs of the world, and then the New York Times and the Washington Post of the world. And then it gets out there and people just kind of reblog it all the time. And that's how the news trickles down and gets cheap. And there's no way to really stop that because of the mandate to have an educated electorate. So these organizations do matter. You do need the old media in order for the new media to be as effective as it is today. It's the same thing where we talked about Arrested Development and Veronica Mars, and how like the online communities have rallied together to put these things back in business. Mm-hmm. The fact is, without their old media, their traditional media origin, the online community wouldn't even know these properties exist. And we really have to realize that it's not a question of just throwing out these old media guys. They serve a purpose.
I agree. But I think nowadays with journalism, the line is getting more and more blurred. And I think that there's almost a symbiotic relationship now with investigative journalists and people and citizen journalists, like people who who are at the scene and have Twitter at the at the ready, and are providing like immediate updates.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's you're right. That those immediate updates do matter, but someone has to curate that. And the fact of the matter is, when Edward Snowden dropped his information, he did it, you know, to the Guardian newspaper in England. Mm-hmm. When Bradley Manning's stuff was given to WikiLeaks, WikiLeaks then dropped it to the Washington Post and the New York Times. They needed these organizations with their expertise to disseminating information to, you know, disseminate it, to curate it, to understand it, to take a deep and critical look at the information and to apply that expertise to its discussion. If you threw that stuff at Johnny on the spot with a Google Blogger account, you wouldn't be able to pull out all of the relevant details that are actually impacting. You wouldn't be able, for lack of a better term, to drill down into what it actually means.
All right. Well, on that note, Dwayne, why don't you tell us about the drill down video of the week this week?
Right. So this week, the video is from a new organization called HelloFlow. It follows a model that's similar to the Dollar Shave Club, if you're familiar with that. Basically, for the last as long as humanly possible, women have been hanging out with this friend who shows up every month or so. And HelloFlow basically makes it so that you don't have to go out and buy your feminine hygiene products. They'll ship it to you. And in fact, because those days can be rough, they'll ship you a care package. You set up what it is you want to receive, and you're getting everything from chocolate and roses along with your tampons or maxi pads, or you're just getting your regular stuff. Regardless, it's a subscription service for something that is defined in many ways by its regularity. So that's the video, and you guys should check it out, because the way they lay it out is hilarious. It's socially complex, and it's done at a summer camp by people who don't even think the characters are not even sort of like in a sexual place. They're just kind of in a like, what the hell's going on place. That's what matters.
You know, what's interesting about this is that, you know, the way you've explained it, you gave us a very compelling case for what, for their service, but nothing gets the message across better than, word of mouth, and this viral video does exactly that. I mean, this was the definition of the term viral, the way this spread across the net this week.
And I mean, Adweek had it on as their video of the day, their marketing video of the day, and there's a reason for it. So go to HelloFlow.com, check out the video. It's also on YouTube. The links are going to be on the show page.
Yep.
Check it out. You just can't beat it. It's hilarious, and it's about time.
Yes. I think that's going to do it for this show this week. So let me go around the table here, and I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on The Drill Down?
Check me out at twitter.com, twitter.com/DwayneD. You can also check me out at flavors.me/DwayneD. And when I'm not there, you can find me here on The Drill Down.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321 and also find our other podcast and ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
An excellent podcast, by the way. If you got an idea for the story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilleddown.com. If you have a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.